Our next guest is an assistant professor in epidemiology of microbial. Am I saying that pronounced? Am I pronouncing that right? Microbial?
Microbial?
Microbial, yeah.
This is why he's the doctor and we
are.
Yeah,
this is true. Yeah. And I have a degree in communications, by the way.
We speak good.
As well as an associate adjunct professor of law and research scholar over at the law school at Yale. Co-director of the Yale Law School, Yale School of Public Health, Global Health Justice Partnership, and the Yale Law School. Wow. Yale School of Public Health. This is what a resume this gentleman has. I'm impressed, as I should be. Huh? His research focuses on the use of quantitative models for improving the response to epidemic diseases. For more than 30 years, he's worked on HIV, AIDS, and other global health issues with several organizations, including the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, the Treatment Action Group, Gay Men's Health, and the AIDS and Rights Alliances for Southern Africa. My goodness, I can't wait to speak with him. It's Greg Gonsalves. Good morning, Greg.
Morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I was just reading your bio here. It's very impressive. Oh, my goodness. I bet you're a busy guy right now.
Not too busy to talk to you guys.
So. Oh, man. See, compliments like that, Christian, get you everywhere with us. I guess the golden question is, what's in your pipeline? What are you hearing as far as coming up with something to slow down the spread, if not completely eradicate the spread of this coronavirus?
So there's good news and there's bad news.
Oh,
which one do you want? You want the good news?
The good news. What do you think I want first? What do you think would be better?
So let's start with the bad news.
All right, let's start with that. It's always good to end on a good note. Okay.
Yeah, so the bad news is that we have a worldwide pandemic, something we probably haven't seen in our lifetimes, unless we're, you know, over 100 years old, because we're talking about the great influenza of 1918.
Right.
That's the sort of scope and scale of this epidemic, although that epidemic did and will kill far more people than coronavirus will. But we're talking about a bug, a microbe, a virus that has seeded itself all across the planet, and is probably, in the United States in particular, bubbling below the surface because we haven't tested many people around the country. So very few people in the United States will know if they're infected until they develop symptoms, if they develop symptoms at all. And so, you know, we've all been asked to social distance over the past week or so, and it looks like it's going to go on for weeks or several more months, because unless we can keep infections from spreading across our communities, we don't see them, but they're happening, right?
Right.
You know, you think of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, well, think of 6 degrees of coronavirus.
Oh, no.
We're all connected to each other, and so we have to break those chains, because that's our only hope in the short term. A vaccine or a treatment could be, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months out. And so the social distancing measures that we're all putting up with, I'm sitting in my apartment, I haven't been out for like 2 days, are what we need to do, even though we may think, you know, nothing seems to be going on out there. It's our best defense against the virus at this point, because we know the hospitals in Connecticut and New York and surrounding states are starting to get overwhelmed with patients. We're starting to see that surge of deaths, surge of cases that are going to need ventilators, that are going to need to be in ICU beds. And so what we can do is to as New Haven, where I live, New Haven County, where I live, Connecticut, is to do what we're being told right now, which is to stay at home. But for all intensive purposes, unless you need to go out to get groceries or to go to the pharmacy to get medicines, not sneak through loopholes like they're having people over for dinner or having play dates, really sort of intensifying our isolation so we can break the chain of infection. I do think if we can do that, we can mitigate the damage that this virus is going to cause, not just in Connecticut, but around the United States and around the world. This is a world historical event that none of us have ever lived through. You know, none of us, maybe our grandparents and our great grandparents lived through World War I, World War II, and the Great Influenza, but we've never had a worldwide calamity like this in our lifetimes. And it's here, sadly, and it's here to stay for the foreseeable future.
Oh, man. You know, when you hear, when do you predict the it'll peak here in the United States?
Well, what, you know, there have been different mathematical modelers who suggested that by social distancing, we can push the surge of new infections down and spread it out over the next few months. If you've looked at the sort of what's happened in China yesterday, I think they reported no cases. You know, let's wait and see what happened. But you know, it's December, January, February, March. You know, 3 to 4 months. You know, with strong social distancing, which we have not done in this country, with robust testing, like we have not done in this country. You know, they were able to sort of tamp it down. After 3 to 4 months. We don't have the benefit of the social distancing that happened in Wuhan, China, and the citywide lockdowns. We don't have the benefit of the sort of robust and widespread testing that South Korea and other countries did. So, you know, let's say, you know, in these countries that have had better responses to the epidemic, they're starting to see an effect after 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. And it could be 6 to 8 months for us, at least.
Wow. Before we peak. I'm hearing, or I've actually heard this very morning, that we are at 75% regarding our of respirators, that we only have about 25% respirators to go before we completely run out. Beds are a little different. I think we're at a shortage for beds, but it's not as dire as respirators. What happens then? For those who are vulnerable, either because they're of their age or because they've got a pre-existing condition, particularly in respiratory?
Well, but I was just on a phone with some colleagues. We're going to have to make hard choices about who lives and who dies.
Oh, my
goodness.
Don't
want to be, but you seriously, you do not want to be an infectious disease doctor at Yale New Haven Hospital or Hartford Hospital right now, because at a certain point they're going to say, Is it she or is it he who's going to get the respirator? Because we don't have enough to go around.
Well, how do you make that decision then?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we were just talking about it, you know, on a conference call a few minutes ago. Is it try to maximize the benefit for as many people in your hospital as possible? Is it, is it a random draw? It's a complex ethical issue that, you know, none of us have, we may academically be trained to understand how to make these or to sort through the different choices. But when you're standing in front of a patient, if you're a physician, these are the hard choices that are going to be made. I heard earlier today that New York City hospitals are about 4 days away from having to make these sort of gruesome decisions. And, you know, Yale New Haven and Hartford Hospital and hospitals around the state are going to have to make the same decisions as well. So when everybody thinks, oh, it doesn't look so bad out there, and, you know, nobody I know is sick right now, this is maybe too overblown and, you know, people are being hysterical, I would say, you know, just wait. You know, in a couple of weeks, we're going to see friends and family starting to get sick. I've already seen several friends sort of post online that, you know, they were tested positive and one person's in isolation. So we're going to start to see the sort of toll of the epidemic and symptomatic infections over the next 3 or 4 weeks. And then I think it's going to become real to a lot of people. But between now and then, we can make a difference by staying home, social distancing, trying to break the chain of infection so that we can sort of reduce the sort of impact of this disease over the long term. You know, for every sort of chain that we refuse to break, every sort of, you know, trip to go visit a friend or to go out to do something fun, you know, we're basically giving the virus an additional chance to sort of make its way sneakily through our communities and go from one person to the next. Because everybody you meet, you have to think of all the people they met that day.
Right, like you said, six degrees of Kevin Bacon there, six degrees of coronavirus. So you're saying that you believe there's a lot of people who are in deep denial about the severity of this virus.
So one is, I'm in public health, so we saw this coming and we've understood sort of the extent of it. But remember, this is unprecedented in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
None of us have ever seen a worldwide pandemic like the 1918 flu. And even if this is not as gruesome as that is, it's hard to sort of conceptualize and sort of imagine in our heads that we could see, you know, if we don't do anything better than we're doing, we could see a million deaths or more, maybe 2 million deaths in this country. And you know, it's not going to be it's not going to be an equal opportunity killer. It's going to be our grandparents and our parents who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s are going to get hurt. It's going to be people who are the most vulnerable in our communities that we're going to have to say goodbye to.
This is alarming information. You said you had some good news, too. I can't wait to hear this.
Well, the good news is that, you know, we don't have a vaccine and we do not have a treatment. There are people working hard on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have, you know, the state of Connecticut, the city of New Haven, all of us in the United States can bond together to try to stop the virus. And we, you know, everybody can go, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a health person. The people who are going to be able to break the chain of infection are the ordinary people. As I'm looking out on my street in New Haven, all my neighbors, you know, as long as we stay in our houses and minimize our social contacts, we are doing more than to combat the virus and this pandemic than anything out there in sort of the pipeline for treatments right now.
Yeah.
And it means that your listeners, that everybody in the radio station has a role to play. And it may sound sort of sentimental and sort of corny, but the point is that in a pandemic like this, the front line of the battle are all of us out in Connecticut, in New Haven, Hartford, or around the state who can basically say, you know, I'm not going to contribute to onward infection. I'm going to break the 6 degrees of coronavirus.
We're here talking with Dr. Greg Gonsalves. He's an epidemiologist from Yale University. And it's an honor to be speaking with you this morning. People, though, they have that a persistent question, and people are prognosticating, as you well know, that, well, this will be over in a couple of weeks or maybe a month or, you know, 2 months at the latest. And but what you're saying is because this is unprecedented and you're comparing it to something that happened, you know, in 1918, although that may have been more severe. There's nobody, you know, or not many people alive right now who lived through something like, or if they did, they were very, very young at the time. We have a certain way of life and liberties and freedoms that we don't want to give up. You know, we have routines and we love our sports teams and we love to go driving and taking advantage of warmer weather when it comes here eventually. And family outings. Are you thinking that 2020 is going to be, for all intents and purposes, the year that never was, and we better start thinking about a year from now?
So, I'm not going to predict what's going to happen in 6 months, but I do think of this as London during the Blitz. You know, we are going to pull together, and we have lots of values we cherish, but some of them are family and community and friendship, and again, not to be corny, but love for one another, and that's how we're going to survive this. Yeah, it would be great to go out to a baseball game or to go see a movie or to go out to dinner or go have drinks with your friends. But, you know, we're going to have to figure out other ways of solidarity. It's, you know, it's life during wartime for the next few months. And we're going to have to hunker down and figure out, you know, new ways to be American besides for sort of the things we sort of cherish as those sort of standard day-to-day things that we like to do. But, you know, I do feel confident that we can beat it. And I think it's going to be about who we are as a state and who we are as a country. And it's not relying on the political leaders, although they need to get off the dime and do better than they're doing. But it's about us and us sort of rallying together to sort of make sure that we can do what's necessary to break the chain of infection.
What can political leaders do?
Well, look, we botched the response to the epidemic. We had 3 months to plan, and, you know, start testing in December into January, into February, and we didn't plan. We downplayed it because one is it's hard to conceptualize a catastrophe like this, and some because there is incompetence and bumbling all the way up the chain of command, in our federal government. And we're in a little bit of a state of denial and wanting to downplay the epidemic. And now we're scrambling to get more tests online. We're trying to deal with the question you raised earlier about, you know, the supply of ventilators, the shortage of ICU beds. You know, people are reusing masks in hospitals. They're reusing gowns. People don't have, you know, they're being told to put bandanas on instead of a hospital mask. You know, all this could have been started planning 3 months ago. And, you know, I have to say, you know, I've watched lots of epidemics sort of roll around the world and watched Republican and Democratic presidents respond to them in equal measure and in pretty good ways, but this is sort of, you know, a unique failure of the president in initiating a response in December that would have put us in a situation where we were South Korea or one of the countries that have been able to sort of stop the sort of onslaught of this pandemic, and we lost 3 months of time. But now we can write to our congresspeople, we can call our congresspeople, we can call the White House, we can call our governors, we can call our city councilors and say, you know, you need to do the right thing. You know, it's not only breaking the chain of infection, it's sort of, you know, it's like that old sort of elementary school citizenship class. You know, you need to sort of, you know, figure out how you're going to influence the federal government so they move on what we need. You know, there are going to be a lot of people unemployed, over the next few months.
Oh, yeah.
And how are we going to get money to them so that people can put food on the table? I talked to my sister already. She's like, I don't know if my company's going to make it. You know, and she's a, you know, she's a sole breadwinner. It's like, it's real. And, you know, people can start to collect unemployment insurance, but, you know, people are going to need money now, today. How are we going to get that done?
And, sure.
You know, they're squabbling in Congress about how they're going to do it, when they're going to do it, you know, who deserves it. The point is, we don't have time for that. People are going to need to put food on the table tomorrow.
And just prior to you coming out, we had somebody from the SBA on to talk about small businesses, and we've had economists on, and we're going to continue to have them on. That's a whole other perspective. Keep in mind, though, China withheld a lot of information from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
They weren't exactly forthright.
You know what? But what we knew in December was enough to move. You know, we knew in December that there was going to be worldwide spread of this. You know, because everybody in public health was talking about it. Everybody's like, when are they going to do something?
I thought he acted within a reasonable amount of time. I mean, in comparison to viruses of the past, where sometimes it took 5-6 months.
No. I mean, no. It's not the case how it happened here in the U.S. We just it was a failure. It was, you know, a guy named somebody did refer to it in the healthcare field as the greatest public health failure in a century. So it's not on the margins like this. You know, he did better than this person or that person or in general. People are thinking this is an unprecedented pandemic, but also an unprecedented public health failure. And, you know, my preference right now is to pull together and get our government to do what it needs to do, even if it's 3 months too late, because we don't have to, we can point fingers and blame people after this is over. The point is now we don't have very much time to lose, as all our hospitals are going to start to be overwhelmed, but sick patients, economic and social ties start to fray. We're going to see a lot of turmoil in the U.S.
How concerned are you for the doctors and the nurses and the caregivers that are on the front line, and they themselves exposing themselves to the coronavirus and hopefully not going back to their families, but self-quarantining on their own, you know, and only to head right back to the very hospital or clinic or medical center?
So in Italy, many of the people who died from coronavirus infection were physicians and nurses and other hospital personnel. So they're in extreme danger of getting sick and dying. There are protocols in place that if somebody has a mild form of the disease, they go into self-isolation. You know, they'll be, before they're allowed back on a ward or on the hospital floor, they'll be tested to make sure there's no virus in them. But what I worry about are the healthcare workers who are now in the hospitals without masks or reusing masks or without, you know, shortages of gowns in hospitals. You know, all these things we take for granted are now in very short supply. So I fear for my doctor and nurse and physician assistant friends because, you know, radiologists, you know, x-ray technicians,
sure.
People, orderlies, everybody in the hospitals now are at increased risk of catching this. And, you know, they're going to make up a large chunk of the sick and infected. So.
And then what? You know, I mean, that's the sad thing is these are the ones who, you know, are caring for us. I worry about that as well. Before we're running out of time, I only got a couple of minutes left. This originated in Wuhan, China. Did somebody had told me, and I don't know if this is true. I don't even know if you're the right person to ask. Did this originate because somebody was eating that, you know, certain type of food, or where? Or somebody else even said this could be germ warfare.
So coronaviruses are very, very common viruses, right?
Sure.
And infections jump from animals to humans all the time. You know, HIV came from chimpanzees. You know, lots of disease. Flu comes from a cycle in pigs. You know, this virus looks like it jumped from a bat host to a human host. It could have been somebody bitten. Who knows what happened? The point is that these are events that are happening all the time, all across the world. And we unluckily stumbled upon a transmission event from animal to human, which involved a virus that was highly infectious, had high mortality, and in our modern world, we're all connected, right? 6 degrees of coronavirus.
That's right.
We're all connected, and so it raced around the world. On the airplanes we use to take vacations and do business travel. We're in an interconnected world, and so a virus jumping from a bat to a human in China, or from a pig in Sierra Leone, or a mouse in New Mexico could set up a worldwide pandemic, and we finally hit the nightmarish jackpot of a perfect storm of conditions that allowed this pandemic to flourish.
Well, we can't concern ourselves with the past. It's only about moving forward and taking the right measures and taking the right precautions. And hopefully people here, you know, heed this advice that you are providing to our listeners today. It's, you know, a vaccine 6 to 12 or perhaps even 18 months out. But prior to even getting to the vaccine, at least slowing down, you know, the spread. It's how rapidly that this is spreading that I think is the most alarming. I only got about 30 seconds left, and I'm going to give that to you. Any last 30 seconds worth of advice?
So stay at home.
Yeah. Okay.
if you go out, stay 6 feet away from people who are not, you know, your partners or your family members. Social distancing is key, and everybody in Connecticut should be doing it and following the public health protocols, because that's our greatest hope at this current moment.
All right. Well, thanks very much. We really appreciate all your time with us this morning.
Anytime. Just give me a call if you need me again.
I will. I thank you for that invitation. You can count on that. I will be talking to you soon. Thanks so much.